David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal. And today our guest is Eduardo Gallardo, an M&A partner at Gibson Dunn, co-head of its M&A practice and head of its shareholder activism defense practice. Eduardo, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, David, for having me.
So we're going to talk about several things on today's podcast. First of all, a little bit about your background, then several issues surrounding shareholder activism, including ESG, how Delaware directors should think about the interests of stakeholders other than shareholders, a little bit about the Williams decision, and finally, a little on the universal proxy. And we'll finish by talking about a couple of hobbies you picked up during the pandemic. So to start, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came to practice M&A law.
Sure, happy to. So I guess by way of background, I actually grew up in Lima, Peru. So I was raised there. I only came to the States after high school. Went to college up at Cornell, so you can imagine how awesome it was to go from the pleasant weather in Lima, Peru to upstate New York. So that was quite a shocker. And after that, I went to Columbia Law and decided to stay in the city. Started my career back in 99 at Skadden in New York. And right from the start, I got sucked into the wonderful world of M&A. And 5-6 years later, as a mid-level senior associate, that I came over to Gibson Dunn again, continuing to focus in M&A and really spending a fair amount of, not most of my time, dealing with public M&A, broadly defined. And that eventually has happened to, I think, many of public M&A people in New York. We managed to incorporate into our practice the wonderful world of shareholder activism. So now my practice is a nice mix of M&A, sort of public M&A and governance matters, board representation, and all that good stuff.
Tell us a little bit about your work in shareholder activism.
Sure. I mean, as you know, David, that's a topic that is of great interest to every public company in this country. Boards care deeply about it. I think they've all come to the realization that activism was not a flavor of the day or the year, as some people thought way back, 10 years ago. It's something that boards need to care about because it's a little bit of a part of their liability management function, right? I mean, companies that get attacked by activists can, experience significant loss of internal resources and distractions, which are just not a good thing. And the best thing that you probably have heard many times before, that the best thing that the boards can do is do their best to preempt that type of situation. So my practice is, a lot of it is, you might call it behind the scenes board advisory. A lot of situations come up on a sort of regular basis where boards are face the threat of activism, get letters, and most of those situations fortunately get resolved on a private basis, right? So a lot of the work I do with boards is counseling them as to how to react to those situations. And I would say the biggest wins I've had in my career, we managed to navigate those instances without things escalating to sort of a public contest, which, unfortunately happens. And those are painful for the board, painful for management, but can be a lot of fun for the advisors.
A lot of activist activity now centers around ESG. How do you talk to boards about ESG issues?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have to start with my little remark I always make when I hear the term ESG, which is, it's incredibly unfortunate that the term ESG, I guess Leo is trying to say EESG, but it's unfortunate that the G has become incorporated into that terminology, the banner, right? Because in my mind, environmental and social issues are incredibly important, right, these days. And governance, yes, it's important, but it's something that has been part of the dialogue since corporations were created, right? Whether you have a staggered board, whether you have a high voting shares, I mean, those are things that are items that shareholders and boards and companies have been talking about for a long time. It's not clear in my mind why that discussion, that dialogue belongs in the same sphere as talking about, you know, environmental, social, labor matters that are, again, in my mind, a totally different discussion, which is really important nowadays. You know, back to your question as to how I talk with boards, I think there is a fundamental shift that has occurred over the last 6 or 7 years across society, right? And it's a good change. It's a realization that we better start caring about these topics or we're in deep trouble, right? Talk about, you know, the environment, right? Climate change is real. And I think most people appreciate that. And that discussion, that way of thinking trickles down from retail shareholders, right? People like you and me that have accounts at big firms or might have investments in private equity, whatever might be the case, we care about those things. At least I care about those things. And whether it's a hedge fund, whether it's a private equity, they realize that people like you and I care about those things. And that way of thinking gets translated into action, right? Now the private equity, the family offices, all those people put pressure downwards on the board of directors of the companies because those people care about it, right? And so it's important, it's fundamental that boards of directors care about these things because the ultimate owners of the stock, not only the intermediaries, not only the Vanguards and State Streets, but the ultimate clients of those entities care about this thing. So what we have is just ultimately this broader dialogue where people are saying you corporations need to care about this thing because us as shareholders care about those things. To me, it's quite a departure from the traditional way of thinking about shareholder value, right? I mean, traditional shareholder value was whether short-term or long-term, but it was about, it's a question about profit of the corporation, which is obviously still very important. But I think people now realize that the dialogue around how you define shareholder value goes beyond what the quarterly results might be.
And so how should boards integrate that set of concerns into thinking about the interests of constituencies other than shareholders?
That's the question of the year. The traditional view, and I think that the law in Delaware continues to be that the ultimate function of the board, its role is to look out for shareholder value, right? And David, I know you're a study of Delaware law and go back to Revlon, right? And Revlon, I think, still makes it clear that board's decisions have ultimately need to be dictated by what's good for the shareholders, right? So the question is, how do you measure what's good for shareholders? And again, I think we are in a world where the law can very much accommodate the interests of these other stakeholders by virtue of the fact that the stakeholders' interests are ultimately the shareholders' interest. And we can talk about sort of an easy example, which I think is seized upon by large institutions where they talk about the environment. They say, well, obviously, if we're thinking about long-term value and we believe that climate change is a reality, then it's clearly in the best interest of shareholders for a company to care about the environment, because ultimately, if there is no world, there is no corporation, right? But I think you can get to the same answer by simply thinking about what your shareholders or your ultimate shareholders care about, right? I mean, there's clearly the case that shareholders at large not only care about value, they care about issues of social justice. They, again, care about the environment. So in my mind, it's appropriate, it's fair game for a board of directors in making decisions about the corporation to think about what these other interests are, not because they're making this large grand equation of, okay, my role is to take into account the interests of shareholders, as shareholders looking for economic value, and then that should be 40% of my calculus, and then I should care about the environment and weigh that 30% and employees another 20%. That's not, in my mind, the way that board should think about it. It's about the shareholder, but let's look at the shareholder and let's look at what shareholders care about. And yes, value is an important consideration, but at the same time, all these other issues, topics are relevant to shareholders per se as value items, right? As relevant to the way they look at value of their corporation. And the board can take all these things into account in making decisions. I think that's, in my mind, the right way to resolve this dialogue or this issue that we're facing in terms of stakeholders, right? I mean, at least in Delaware, obviously, there are other states that have the so-called other constituency statutes that statutorily allow the boards to look at its all these other stakeholders and take those interests directly into account in decision-making, but that's not where Delaware is.
Moving to two more specific issues. First of all, earlier this year, the Court of Chancery issued a significant decision on poison pills in the Williams Company's case. Talk to us a little bit about that decision and what implications it has for boards that may be considering a poison pill or shareholder rights plan.
Sure. I mean, without going too much in detail on the decision, I mean, as people know, that was a pill that was put in place by Williams at the beginning of the pandemic. And it was unusual in that it had a 5% threshold. This was not an NOL pill, right? So we all put pills in at that level when what we're trying to do is protect the NOLs of a corporation, but that was not the case. It was clear, at least according to the opinion, to the factual background, in the opinion that it was put in place to protect the company against shareholder activism, and there was not a specific sort of activist I think they had in mind. Again, all this is just based on the written opinion. Ultimately, the poison pill was challenged, and the Court of Chancery validated the pill, and that was ratified by the Delaware Supreme Court, I think about 2-3 weeks ago. So I think it's fair to say that practitioners were not shocked by the outcome of that opinion. And I think, David, you probably talked to maybe more people than I have around this. But again, I don't think that came as a shocker. I think the fortunate result of that opinion in my mind is that the court used some pretty broad language, I think could be qualified as just dicta, that said that the use of a pill to protect a company against activism, so shareholder activism without a specific threat, might not be in and of itself a reason to activate a poison pill, which I think is fair to say is just not the way that practitioners had been thinking about the pill. The opinion itself, I think, can be pretty much constrained to the facts of Williams. Again, we're dealing with a 5% pill, and there was this broad definition of beneficial ownership, which I think you won't see much around after Williams. But all in all, I think, again, just gives us a little more things to think about if we were to be implementing a pill, an activist, anti-activist pill going forward. I think that the court did leave the possibility open that, you know, pill might be appropriate, not at the 5% level, but generally appropriate if what you're trying to solve for is disclosure deficiencies, right? So for years, people have been thinking about the consequence of the fact that Schedule 13D and SEC rules only pick up beneficial ownership. Beneficial ownership does not necessarily pick up derivative securities. So there are various ways for activists to get around the 13D filing. And I think the Williams decision definitely leaves the doors wide open for a board to consider this disclosure deficiencies into whether an activist or general anti-activist bill should be put in place. And again, this is, if you're dealing with a specific activist situation, there's an immediate threat of activism. I think certainly Williams doesn't impede your ability to put a pill in those situations.
Moving to federal regulation that's relevant to shareholder activism, what's the current status of the discussion about the universal proxy?
So the universal proxy was just mandate, or the SEC just approved new rules this past week mandating the use of a universal proxy card starting for meetings that happen after August 31st, 2022. So we still have a few more months before the rules become effective, but certainly a big change in the way that proxy contests for director elections are going to, you know, unfold going forward. I mean, the topic of the universal proxy card has been debated by, you know, professors and intellectuals and practitioners, I think, for at least the last 5 years. So it was not an unexpected move by the SEC. The timing, this was a little bit unexpected because the rules were, again, first introduced back in 2016. And the comment period was not only, must reopen only, it was April of this year. But so what this means is that starting in the fall of next year, right? Every time there's a contest for director or directors, both sides are going to have to include in their proxy cards the other side's slate, which is very different than the way contests are typically run these days, where each card is only going to include the slate of the party distributing the cards. So there'll be two cards floating out there. One will be the company with the company nominees and the activists with their nominees. Except for short slates where they might cherry pick some of the company slate, but it's sort of a binary choice that shareholders would have. Now, with this universal card, each shareholder will be able to mix and match and come up with their slate of choice with combining the two basic slates, which I think is a big deal. I mean, it's a big deal because this is going to, in my view, just incentivize more activists to launch campaigns because their odds in general will be better at getting at least one or two of their sort of dissident slate on the board, right? I think that a lot of shareholders who previously had this binary choice and ultimately decided to pick the management card, which would have prevented them from picking, you know, nominees of the dissident, now will be able to, again, pick one or two and include them in their vote. So again, I think that's going to lead to a world where any reasonable activist with an okay or maybe not okay investment thesis to be able to get two other people on the board. And that's going to increase the number of contests, I think. It's going to put a floor of one at any type of settlement discussions. And I think also you should not underestimate the role that's going to play with ISS and Glassfoot, right? Before, the proxy advisor firms had to make a recommendation to vote on one of the two cards. Now I think this universal proxy is going to liberate them and encourage them or make them more willing to incorporate, again, one or two dissidents into their recommendation, knowing that the shareholders can vote on management's universal proxy card.
Did you get a sense, talking to people from ISS and Glass Lewis before this, that had they been able to do it, they would have made some of those recommendations that shareholders vote for a split slate, some management candidates, some insurgent candidates, but obviously until now, ISS and Glass Lewis haven't been able to make that recommendation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear from not only discussions, but I think if you look at the actual, you know, recommendations they made in a number of situations, I don't know if they outright, but they certainly strongly implied that their dream slate would have been to cherry pick some people from both slates. I mean, even ISS, I think, values and Glass Lewis value the continuity or institutional knowledge that comes from people who have been on the board, continuing so, and sort of they will argue it's always good to bring fresh blood into the mix. So I don't think it's a big secret that this is going to be nirvana for ISS and Glass Lewis. Now they can do, I think, what they would have liked to do many times in the past.
And then finally, tell us a little bit about the hobbies you picked up during the pandemic.
So I don't know if it falls with us as a hobby, but right around the time the pandemic started, so, you know, late February, early March, I was actually reading this bio of Albert Einstein's, there's a Walter Isaacson one, which was pretty neat. I mean, just as a bio, but I really got struck by the chapter. So it was more of like a very, where the author gave a pretty general view of special relativity. And I have not taken physics since high school. I didn't do any much of any science in college. I just thought it would be pretty neat to actually understand special relativity. So I did spend a few months last year kind of teaching myself, a non-science major, trying to teach myself relativity, which actually I think I probably did as well as I could have under the circumstance. And certainly I'm no expert in the math. Go beyond my capabilities, but that was a neat exercise. And the other thing I did pick up, or maybe I went back to my childhood with Legos and did a pretty cool, I don't know how many thousand pieces Lamborghini. And maybe again, going back to my childhood, and maybe the pandemic forced many of us to just start thinking back to the good old days and of our childhood. But what I did is start building model planes, which I did like very simple ones as a kid, but these are much more sophisticated in the models that you buy the boxes, and they come, you know, I don't know, hundreds of little pieces that you have to glue together and paint. And I don't know, it's nice. It's relaxing. It's, I guess, the equivalent of meditation for other people. But it's just, it was a nice exercise that kind of forced me for some periods of time, you know, usually in the evening, to be able to put my phone aside and just distract myself with something different. So that was maybe the, look at the silver lining, the one good thing that came out of this whole COVID mess for me.
Eduardo, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, David. It was great. Thank you.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.